From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Protesters shouting, "Ashcroft kills and dead addicts can't recover," disrupt Ashcroft's Senate confirmation hearings. Congolese leader Laurent Kabila is reportedly shot dead in a coup attempt. On the 10th anniversary of the Gulf War, a DOE letter reveals that depleted uranium used by the U.S. in Iraq and the Balkans was contaminated with deadly plutonium. Protesters go to jail over Clinton's Iraq policy. We'll speak with Dan Berrigan in a New York City jail and a look at the Clinton legacy in Iraq. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Hearings on the confirmation of John Ashcroft for Attorney General are taking place in the Senate. They began yesterday with senators making their opening statements. This is Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for holding these hearings. They may well be the most important hearings that our committee will have this year. The power and reach of the Department of Justice is vast, and the person at its head must have the ability and the commitment to enforce the laws vigorously. The reality and perception of fairness must be without question. During Senator Ashcroft's quarter century in public service, he has taken strong positions on a range of important issues in the jurisdiction of the Justice Department. Unfortunately and often, he has used the power of his high office to advance his personal views in spite of the law of the land. The vast majority of Americans support vigorous enforcement of our civil rights laws, and those laws and the Constitution demand it. Senator Ashcroft, however, spent significant parts of his term as Attorney General of Missouri and his term as governor strongly opposing school desegregation and voter registration in St. Louis. The vast majority of Americans believe in access to contraception and a woman's right to choose, and our laws and Constitution demand it. Senator Ashcroft does not, and his intense efforts have made him one of the principal architects of the ongoing right-wing strategy to dismantle Roe v. Wade and abolish a woman's right to choose. Deep concerns have been raised about his record on gun control. He has called James Brady the leading enemy of responsible gun owners. Senator Ashcroft is so far out of the mainstream that he has said citizens need to be armed in order to protect themselves against a tyrannical government. Our government? Tyrannical? In fact, he relies on an extreme reading of the right to bear arms under the Second Amendment to the Constitution to oppose virtually all gun control laws. He doesn't show the same respect for the right of free speech under the First Amendment. In 1978, as Attorney General of Missouri, he tried to use the antitrust laws to undermine the right to free speech of the National Organization for Women and prevent a boycott of Missouri by the organization over the state's refusal to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. As these few examples demonstrate, the clear question before the Senate is whether, if confirmed as Attorney General, Senator Ashcroft will be capable of fully and fairly enforcing the nation's laws to benefit all Americans, even though he profoundly disagrees with many of the most important of those laws. His past actions strongly suggest that he will not. Senator Ashcroft's record in Missouri and in the Senate is extremely troubling on this basic question. Many of us, probably all of us, who have served with Senator Ashcroft, respect his ability on the issues and his intense commitment to the principles he believes in, even though we disagree profoundly with some of those principles. We know that while serving in high office, he has time and again aggressively used litigation and legislation in creative and inappropriate ways to advance his political and ideological goals. How can we have any confidence at all that he won't do the same thing with the vast new powers he will have at his disposal as Attorney General of the United States? President-elect Bush has asked us to look in Senator Ashcroft's heart to evaluate his ability and commitment to enforce the laws of our country. But actions speak louder than words, and based on his repeated actions over many years, it's clear that Senator Ashcroft's heart is not in some of the most important of the nation's laws. The person who serves as Attorney General must inspire the trust and respect of all Americans. Inscribed in stone over the center entrance to the Department of Justice is this phrase: "The place of justice is a hallowed place." All Americans deserve to have confidence that when the next Attorney General walks through the doors of justice and into that hallowed place, he will be serving them too. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I look forward to the hearings.
Senator Ted Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts, in his opening statement in the confirmation hearing of John Ashcroft as Attorney General of the United States.
Sad. I lie sleepless and I groan. Nobody cares when a man goes mad. He is sorry. God is glad. Shadow changes into bone. Shadow changes into bone.
Allen Ginsberg, Refrain, here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to our listeners across the country on this now, the last 3 days of the Clinton era. We've entered those last 3 days now, and already the winds of the new administration are blowing around.
That's right. In the last segment of the program, we're going to be looking at the Clinton legacy when it comes to Iraq. But right now, we're continuing with the Ashcroft confirmation hearings, which is continuing today in the Senate Judiciary Committee, which, by the way, John Ashcroft was a member of. And just as those hearings got started yesterday, there was a protest in the hall. We're going to go right now to Michael Kink, who is legislative counsel to Housing Works. 4 people got arrested. They were from that organization. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael.
Immediately after John Ashcroft's statement, 4 men of color living with the HIV virus immediately stood up shouting, "Ashcroft kills and dead addicts can't recover." They were staff and clients of Housing Works, the New York City-based AIDS housing and advocacy organization, and were protesting Ashcroft's leadership of the fight against needle exchange programs that are proven to reduce the spread of HIV. In the Senate, Ashcroft fought to kill funding for needle exchange programs. He fought to kill funding for studies that prove the effectiveness of needle exchange programs. He fought to stop Washington, D.C. AIDS groups from spending their own money on needle exchange programs. And he fought hard against drug reforms and efforts to eliminate racial disparities in sentencing that also hit drug users and people of color, the folks who are most at risk for the HIV virus in America today. They were charged with a misdemeanor disruption of Congress. They were released from jail about 4 o'clock this morning, and they considered the protest a successful way to highlight Ashcroft's opposition to saving lives through effective HIV prevention methods.
Let's go to the sound of that protest yesterday that took place during the Senate Judiciary confirmation hearing of John Ashcroft.
The committee will be in order. The committee will stand in recess until the police can restore order. Officer, restore order.
That's Senator Leahy of Vermont, until one of his colleagues also speaks up. The protesters are being bodily picked up at this point.
Thank you.
They're trying to figure out what they're saying.
Put them out and keep them.
That's Strom
Thurmond. The committee will also stay in order.
And that is the protest that took place yesterday. Michael Kink, you say that Ashcroft was responsible for helping to kill federal funding of Needle Exchange. Was he the leader in this?
He provided the leadership in the Senate. He provided powerful rhetoric. I have to say that it was conscienceless politicians from both parties. President Clinton also did his bit to stop efforts within the Department of Health and Human Services to fund needle exchange programs. But Ashcroft has made it one of his high-profile issues, and it just cuts exactly against the public health principles. The Surgeon General has found that needle exchange programs reduce the spread of HIV by over half, that they don't increase drug use, that they increase the ability of drug users to access treatment programs. So the public health reality is that needle exchange programs work. The political reality is that politicians like John Ashcroft and even Bill Clinton, who are willing to pander to public misunderstanding of the programs, are really threatening the lives of thousands of Americans who are at risk for HIV.
Well, we're going to turn now to Senator Kennedy questioning John Ashcroft in the hearings yesterday.
If we could, Senator Ashcroft, come back to the St. Louis situation. Let me just spell out very briefly, as you remember, but just so that we have the common understanding. In the 70s, more than 20 years after the Brown v. Board of Education, St. Louis still maintained a segregated school system. Finally, responding to the lawsuits brought by the parents, the court stepped in and ruled the state of Missouri and the St. Louis School Board were jointly responsible for violating the Constitution by creating and maintaining segregated and grossly unequal schools. The court ruled that the state had maintained an elaborate set of laws to enforce segregation. At one time, the state law even forced black children who lived in the suburbs and in white city neighborhoods to be bused to all black inner city schools. According to the state had completely abdicated its constitutional duty to desegregate the schools. You disagreed with that finding, but despite your repeated appeals, requests for injunctions, three denials of review by the Supreme Court over a four-year period, the final ruling of the courts were not changed. So you had your chance in the courts to make the case that you've just made here and rejected on each time. Now, let me just continue. You'll have as much chance on the other time. Now, the city of St. Louis and its schools and surrounding 23 county districts all accepted the ruling. They negotiated a model desegregation plan relying on the voluntary public school. Black students from city schools could volunteer, transfer to white suburban schools. White suburban students would have the opportunity to transfer to magnet schools run by the city. In fact, the plan had a lifeline, what has been a lifeline for tens of thousands of students, with graduation rates that are consistently twice as high for the transfer students. More of them going on to college, and over 11,000 students are still using it today, including 900 suburban students. Now, given the voluntary nature of the desegregation plan, the fact that the city and county school districts all agreed to it, how do you justify your relentless opposition to the voluntary school desegregation and sort of a scorched-earth legal strategy to try and block it?
Senator Kennedy, first of all, the litany of charges that were made about the state's activities included a rather loose definition of things that the state had done prior to Brown versus Board of Education. Virtually none of the offensive activities described in what you charged happened in the state after Brown versus Board of Education. And as a matter of fact, most of them had been eliminated far before Brown versus Board of Education. Secondly, in saying that the city maintained a segregated school system into the 70s is simply a way of saying that after Brown versus Board of Education, when citizens started to flee the city and move to the county, and you'll know that St. Louis for a number of decades now has been a place that has lost more population than virtually any other city as people moved into the county, the schools, as people changed their location, began to be more intensely segregated. That was after the rules of segregation had been lifted, and it was not a consequence of any state activity. Then I would just simply say that I think it's unfair to call the program totally voluntary and to suggest that we opposed a voluntary program when the thing was that the state was going to have to pay for everything people volunteered to do. Now, the situation was basically this. The county school districts agreed with the city school districts that they could confess judgment and get a lot of money from the state of Missouri by saying, if we'll just say that we'll do this voluntary plan, the state will have to pay for the situation. So you had a situation something like this, and I don't have all the material that you all have, but let me try and recreate it from my memory.
Yeah, I want to give you a fair chance, but we're all...
Thank you for your fairness, because when the machine gun of charges comes out, I want to try and respond to all of the lead.
Well, let me give you one point that you've just raised, because I want to move on. And earlier you said, well, the state wasn't involved.
Well,
now let me just read you. Now, in 1980, in the Adams v. United States, the city board and the state were jointly responsible for maintaining segregated school system. 1982, we again noted that the state and the city board. My question is, how costly was this going to be, Senator Ashcroft, before you were going to say that those kids going in lousy schools, that you were going to do something about it? You were there as an attorney general, you were there as governor, and did virtually nothing about it. And a new governor came in, Mel Carnahan, and resolved that and basically accepted it. You used every kind of device to oppose it. You have the Economist magazine says, which is not a liberal magazine, saying the campaign, and you were involved in a campaign, quickly degenerated in the 1984 when this was still before you, into a contest over who was most opposed to the plan for voluntary racial desegregation at St. Louis schools. Mr. McNary claimed that Mr. Ashcroft had not done enough to defeat the plan in court. Mr. Ashcroft countered that Mr. McNary was a closet supporter of racial integration. Both ran openly bigoted advertisement on television. This is what we have in terms of the Gary Orfield, the consultant for the court in St. Louis, leading expert on desegregation cases, testifies against desegregation. He said that you had no positive vision, constantly stirred up racial divisions over the questions. Finally, rather than provide the conciliatory leadership, in 1990, a judicial order described the recent state filings as extremely antagonistic, and said the state was ignoring the real objective of this case, a better education for the city students to personally embark on a litigious pursuit of righteousness. Now, that's a pretty tough record. That's a pretty tough record. Where in your priority were the rights of the interest of those black students that were trying to get a decent education? We've just heard you about what the cost was going to be, how you had a responsibility as an attorney general to protect the taxpayer. What about the interest of those black students and the fact that you have those courts repeatedly, time again, said that you failed to even offer an alternative? Did you offer an alternative?
Now, may I respond?
Sure.
Yeah, thank you. In all of the cases where the court made an order, I followed the order, both as Attorney General and as Governor. It was my judgment that when the law was settled and spoken, that the law should be obeyed. At one point, I had to detail the Deputy Attorney General of the State of Missouri to the State Treasurer's office in order to urge the State Treasurer to write the check. And the treasurer wrote the check.
John Ashcroft being questioned by Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy, the opening of yesterday's confirmation hearings for John Ashcroft as Attorney General of the United States. Those hearings continue today. We'll bring you more tomorrow on Democracy Now! Right now, a break, and then we will talk about the Congo. It looks like the Congolese president may well have been assassinated. We'll look at the significance of the Congo and the killing. Also, later in the program, we go to Iraq to find out what is happening there and to talk with Dennis Halliday, a UN official who quit the United Nations after calling the sanctions against Iraq genocidal. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Congolese officials temporarily placed President Laurent Kabila's son in charge of the government today, a day after numerous foreign officials said the ruler of this troubled nation was shot and killed during a coup attempt. Communications Minister Dominique Sakambi Enongo, who made the announcement on state-run television after an emergency cabinet meeting, insisted Kabila was injured but alive. The news comes as Congolese officials appear to be struggling to fill a power vacuum in the already unstable and war-ravaged Central African country. As dawn broke over the capital today, tanks and soldier-filled trucks patrolled quiet and empty streets as helicopters cruised overhead. We're joined right now by two people. Tajuddin Abdulrahim is General Secretary for Pan-African Movement. He lives in Kampala, Uganda, but is in London right now. Alambe Brath joins us in the studio. He is the producer of Pacifica Station WBAI program called Afro-Kaleidoscope and is chair of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition. Juan?
We'd like to begin first with Tajuddin Abdulrahim. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Could you tell us what is the latest information that you are hearing in terms of what is the fate of Kabila and what actually did happen yesterday?
Well, from all available evidence at this end, and then also speaking to people in the region, it will seem like President Kabila is dead. But there is a lot of confusion in Kinshasa. And in the sense that, I mean, he never even had a formal deputy head of state or anything like that. So whatever the people in power, those who are in government with him are trying to buy some time in order to reorganize themselves so that there can be an effective successor to President Kabila. We also hear that there's a lot of trouble between the politicians and the military because it appeared that there was a coup attempt yesterday. Now the president is killed, but the coup may not have succeeded fully.
Well, there were some reports saying that President Kabila had tried to fire some of the generals around him in the days before the events yesterday. Have you known anything about that?
Well, that has been a big problem right from the time when the President Kabila came in 1997. That the army has been quite unruly, and some elements in it are quite ambitious. So it has been a tussle. I mean, he has remained in power largely because of backing from regional allies.
The latest news we have, since all different reports are coming in now, is that the Congo information minister is saying Kabila was flown out of the country after being shot by a bodyguard. This is a very significant day, Alambe Brath, in the history of the Congo.
Right. So the day is the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. So it's very interesting that Kabila is alleged killed, or attempt was made to kill him, on January the 16th. It comes 4 days before the transition of the government in the United States, as did Lumumba's come before 3 days. Lumumba was killed on January the 17th, and Kennedy was sworn in on the 20th of the same month. And here we find that it happens between a transition government. The transition government in the United States, particularly when one party is coming in and another is going out, have to be briefed on all previous plans that the incumbent government has been dealing with. In the case of the Eisenhower administration, two plans were established. One was the Bay of Pigs, was initiated by Nixon, the vice president, and the other was the killing of Lumumba. So it means that the president-elect has to then be briefed of what is going to happen, have repercussions on his tenure. So you have to believe that Kennedy knew about Lumumba's assassination, one of the reasons why Malcolm said that chickens had come home to roost. In this particular case, you had to believe that George Bush has already been briefed, because all of the plans that they have going on in the Congo, that the first information coming out that had a surety that Kabila had been killed came from a senior intelligence person in Kampala, where Tajuddin is headquartered, and he could probably tell us something about that, and was supposedly from a source inside the Congo's intelligence. So it seems to be a plot that not just from inside the country, but has some repercussions, that the Belgians and, you know, all these other people who are speaking now, very similar, and that is insurrection. That is taking place among the military, because in 1960 it was the Force Publique, which is the Congolese National Army, that was set off, that caused some of the disturbances that led to the secession that brought about this whole calamity.
Well, Alambe, interestingly, in the articles, in, for instance, in today's New York Times, I'm struck by the lack of accurate memory of the reports, talking about, first of all, that the that Patrice Lumumba died under mysterious circumstances. And also talking, the article seems to indicate that the United States welcomed Kabila when he first came to power a few years ago, and when, in fact, the United States had been propping up for years the previous dictatorship.
Yeah, Mobutu Sese Seko, when he came, he was Colonel Joseph Desiré Mobutu. And he was put in there when they usurped the government of Patrice Lumumba, which was a legitimate government. The fact is, though, that the Times and other papers obscure the fact that the warring interests over the minerals of the Congo did not start just in the last 40 years. When they sat down at the Berlin Conference from November 1884 to February 1885, King Leopold, who was the engineer of that conference and was brought under the German chancellor in Berlin, that the major thing he got was the biggest prize, which was the Congo, which was 77 times the size of Belgium. The Congo is the third largest country in Africa. And so for those years, from 1885 to 1908, Leopold killed over 10 million people over rubber. You know, I mean, if you want to read, you know, the books like Edmund Morel, who wrote some outstanding works, and the movements in that particular period, Mark Twain, the poet laureate of the United States, who was very much involved in the movement to free the people in the Congo, called the Congo the graveyard of the United States, which was the godfather of the Congolese graveyard. And after the Congo was relieved from the control, the personal domain of Leopold, the American corporations, including people like the Baruchs, Thomas Ryan and Timber, the same problems were then put under the Belgian government, because the Congo did not become a Belgian Congo until 1908. Prior to that, it was Leopold's, you know, own domain, his own personal fiefdom.
Alave Brath, host of Africa Kaleidoscope on Pacifica Station WBAI here in New York and chair of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition. Many believe that the CIA was involved in Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
That's part of the congressional record, you know, because what happened when Lumumba was killed on the 17th, it was not announced until the 13th of February. They kept it quiet because we were arguing. We want you to produce. I was working very closely with the Congolese mission, you know, as a volunteer, people from the community that came to help Thomas Kanza, who was trying to be seated. The United States blocked his seating and seated the delegation of the President Kasavubu. So we know what happened. Yeah, so they did not announce his death until about a month later.
Well, we'll see when we find out what exactly has happened to the current leader, Laurent Kabila. Again, the reports that he's either been killed or seriously wounded. But we're going to go back to Tajuddin Abdulrahim, General Secretary for the Pan-African Movement now in London, though based in Uganda.
Yes, I'd like to ask you, what's been happening in the past few months in terms of the civil war and Kabila's role in it? Because already the reports that are coming out in the corporate press here in the United States are indicating that Kabila was an obstacle to a peace accord. In essence, he was the one holding up a possible peace accord in the Congo. Could you give us your assessment?
Well, first, let me thank my big brother there, Lombe Bright, for that historical parallel with Lumumba's death. But also, let's not force things in terms of what this means for the region and the Africa. Now, of course, I mean, it will be wrong to hold Kabila solely responsible for stalling the peace process in the Congo. He is indeed, or was indeed, a major factor in the sense that he was the president of the Congo. But what is holding back the peace process in the Congo, in my view, since the Lusaka Accord was put in place, has to do with hypocrisy, nationally, regionally, and internationally. And the fact that this war has become business, and the business of war has overtaken everybody involved. You have corporate interests there, you have arms dealer, and then you have militarists, both on Kabila's side and on the side of the rebels. Now, in my view, if indeed Kabila is dead, it offers an opportunity for going back to Lusaka Accord that guarantees national and regional security, you know, on the basis of identifiable interests of both the country and the various states that are involved. It's not going to be easy, but it is very certain that there cannot be a military solution to the problem of the Congo. Yes, in more recent months, Kabila has suffered more military reversals, and the countries that have been backing him, namely Angola and Zimbabwe, are themselves faced with a lot of internal problems, particularly Zimbabwe, and the war has never been popular. Now, even on the rebel side, the war has never been popular in Uganda, for instance. So therefore, I think the exit of Kabila, who was indeed a major factor, by no means the only factor, offers an opportunity for military disengagement by all the rebel groups and their allies, and also the allies that were based on Kabila's side, and also the promotion of genuine national dialogue between Congolese people, both armed and unarmed groups, in terms of national dialogue, national reconciliation, and the process of establishing a truly government of national unity that can guarantee the interests of the Congolese and also make the Congolese feel secure among themselves and cease to be a source of insecurity to the rest of the region.
Alambe Breath, what's your assessment of what was Kabila's role in either moving forward or stalling the peace process?
Well, basically, I believe in talking to Kabila, you know, on several occasions, the fact is that he was very reluctant to trust the United Nations based on what had happened to Lumumba. And indeed, as Dr. Tajuddin Abdulrahim has pointed out that you know, everyone really wants peace. But the question of the peace was also based on that the UN had also recommended that the withdrawal of the troops would begin first with Uganda and Rwanda, because they were the ones that everybody had agreed, except the people who were charged, that they had invaded the Congo. So that the people who came in, Angola under Dos Santos, Zimbabwe under Mugabe, and of course Namibia under Sam Nujoma, their position was that they came by bilateral agreements to defend the Congo, because if they had not intervened, the Congo would have long been settled into the hands of U.S. imperialism. So the fact is that there was a reluctance on the part of both Uganda and Rwanda. Now, the charges are always leveled against Uganda and Angola and Namibia and Zimbabwe, that they went in for the riches. But those three countries have similar riches. They're having problems even dealing with their own riches, for them to go into another country to try to exploit those riches. But the Uganda and Rwanda, which does not have those riches, have been documented in the United Nations as actually plundering that country and taking riches that they never had before. They came from the Congo.
Well, we have to wrap up this discussion, but we'll certainly follow the developments as they are major in this, well, one of the largest countries in the world, the
right.
Congo.
And the richest countries in the world, more important.
Elambe Brath, host of Afro Kaleidoscope, WBAI Pacifica program here in New York, and chair of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition, Tajuddin Abdulrahim, General Secretary for Pan-African Movement, speaking to us from London, based in Kampala, Uganda. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we hurl forward, because we're joined right now by two people in the Tombs here in New York, which is jail, Kathy Kelly, the co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, and Dan Berrigan, well-known peace activists, both arrested yesterday on the steps of the U.S. consulate in New York. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy. Thank you.
And Dan Berrigan.
Thank you.
In the men's section and the women's section. Kathy Kelly, what were you doing yesterday that ended up with you in jail?
Amy, there were 16 of us who gathered at the U.S. mission to the U.N. We had sought a meeting with Ambassador Richard Holbrooke for 10 days. And we wanted to bring to him an enactment of what we think is an important reality about Iraq, a simple meal of lentils, rice, and untreated water, water we took from the East River. And we just are trying again and again to help Mr. Holbrooke understand how important it is to sow the seeds for the next group that occupies his spot at the U.S. mission to the U.N., to realize that the deterioration of Iraq's infrastructure continues to cause child malnourishment and death.
And Dan Berrigan, you've probably been arrested so many times that the people at the Tombs must know you by now. Just to ask you on this anniversary of the Gulf War, why you participated in the protest?
Well, thank you. It was a great privilege to be with Kathy and the other marvelous, marvelous, unflinching and unwearied people as we tried it once again. I was thinking all during the night and during the period of arrest, I was thinking of Bertolt Brecht, and he says somewhere that if we lose 10 friends who are disappeared or who are slain, there's a great shock. If people lose 100 friends or 1,000 friends, numbness sets in. And when we think of the national numbness about the children of Iraq, it's just overpowering, you know. And the only thing I think that we thought we could do was to put a human face on the children and carry one or two or three of them into jail and say, well, we hope the other end of this will be some kind of mitigation of the murder of children.
Kathy Kelly, you were last in Iraq when?
I spent the summer in Iraq, 7 weeks of this past summer, and then went back again in October. And during the summer months, we lived in a very, very poor neighborhood and literally ate lentils and rice every night for dinner, and in fact, that was the fare throughout the time. So, and we spent in 2 days more money on bottled water for our team of five than came into the family with whom we lived over the course of a month, because we didn't want to drink the unpurified water.
Kathy Kelly and Dan Berrigan, I want to thank you both for being with us from the women and men's side of the Tombs Jail in New York, as you got arrested yesterday demonstrating outside the U.S. mission to the United Nations. Again, today is the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the Gulf War. We're going to be spending the rest of the program on this in all different ways. We'll be joined by Dennis Halliday, who quit the United Nations after heading up the UN program in Iraq, calling the U.S.-UN sanctions genocidal. And we'll be joined by a former ambassador to the United Arab Emirates from the United States, supporting the Clinton administration policy. But before we go to them, we wanted to follow up on and get an update on the situation of depleted uranium with a breaking story. We are going to break first for stations to identify themselves, and we go to Geneva, Switzerland, to Andreas Zumach, who will tell us about the plutonium that's been found in depleted uranium that may explain why so many soldiers are dying. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. A January 2000 Department of Energy letter to the Pentagon notes that the depleted uranium the U.S. uses for its armor-piercing weapons contains, quote, traces of plutonium. NATO officials are meeting today in Brussels to address the continuing crisis over the use of depleted uranium weapons in the Balkans. Although several European nations have linked the weapons to deaths from cancer, NATO and the U.S. have insisted that the radioactivity in depleted uranium is too mild to be harmful. But the presence of plutonium in the munitions is alarming. Plutonium is a highly carcinogenic substance, even in minute amounts. We're joined right now by Andreas Zumach, who is a reporter for various German media outlets in Geneva. What is the significance of this letter that has been found from the DOE to the Pentagon saying there is plutonium in the depleted uranium weapons?
The significance, Amy, is what you already hinted at. It totally changes the story because it totally destroys the defense arguments both NATO and the national defense ministries here in NATO and also the World Health Organization have been putting out over the past 10 days. They've been saying, number one, normal radioactivity of depleted uranium munition cannot cause leukemia. And they have said, second, the radioactive amount is too small to cause anything else. And with plutonium, because, as you said, it takes tiny, tiny amounts, plutonium can cause leukemia, can cause many other types of cancers. The sources for this story is not only the letter you quoted from the DOE to the Pentagon, but also a Pentagon study done in December last year confirming, yes, routinely there is plutonium in all the depleted uranium we use for munition production. And there is a third important link which has to do with the Gulf War. After the Gulf War ended in March 91, there were cleanup operations by U.S. Army personnel. They found plutonium on the Iraqi tank racks. They noted that in their notebooks. At this time, they didn't put any significance to it, and we have seen these notebooks. And I think what needs to be done now, besides NATO and the U.S. government really revealing the whole truth, is we had the U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan coming out 10 days ago claiming credit for the findings that have been made in Kosovo, findings of contaminated sites. These findings have been investigated here in Switzerland, and they also found plutonium, so this is the second source. And Kofi Annan said that he personally had convinced the United Nations Environmental Program to conduct this depleted uranium study in the Kosovo, and he said this was a war which was not backed by the United Nations. And I think the question now to be asked to the Secretary General is, that he should now initiate a study in a war that had been authorized by the Security Council. I'm talking about the Gulf War, and where we have mountains of circumstantial evidence in the form of dead or sick Iraqi civilians and Gulf War veterans in the U.S. and Great Britain that point to the fact that this might be the cause, the depleted uranium with plutonium.
Of course, here in the United States, the mainstream media is still refusing to deal with this. There was a big article over the weekend, front page article in the New York Times, basically trying to play down and say that there was no real danger in depleted uranium. But what do you think now in Europe now, as this continues to spread, what will happen now in terms of pressure on the European governments and also on the U.S. To be more forthcoming about how extensive the even greater dangers of these substances have been?
Well, the story I've been talking about is just about coming out in Germany. There will be a big television story on it tomorrow. As we speak, the German defense minister, Rudolf Scharping, has to answer questions to the defense committee of the German parliament, very tough questions across the board from all political parties, including his own party, the Social Democrats. And I think the defense ministers in the other NATO countries in Europe will come under similar pressure. And the result of the NATO meeting 10 days ago, where they denied any health risk and decided to continue to use the EU munition, I think this is history. And sooner or later, I think we will have a deep crisis of trust and confidence between the Europeans and the Americans if the Pentagon and the U.S. government should decide to continue stonewalling and concealing the truth.
Well, Andreas Zumach, we want to thank you for being with us. A breaking story here on Democracy Now! Andreas Zumach, reporter for various German media outlets, speaking to us from Geneva, Switzerland. Again, the exposure of a Department of Energy letter to the Pentagon now admitting that the depleted uranium weapons do contain traces of plutonium, which could explain why soldiers who were in the Balkans as well as Iraq are dying of leukemia, as well as Kosovo as well, and civilians. Well, as we talk about soldiers and civilians, we're going back to Iraq as President Clinton prepares to leave office. We'll take a look at the last decade of U.S. policy towards Iraq. During this time, Iraq has gone from relative prosperity to massive poverty and has seen the death of somewhere around 1.5 million citizens, 600,000 of them children under 5. While U.S. officials claim the Iraqi government could use revenues from the oil for food program that's being implemented by the United Nations to feed its people, U.N. officials have declared the program hopelessly inadequate. Dennis Halliday joins us in the studio. He's the former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, and he oversaw the oil for food program in Iraq until he quit, saying, "I've been instructed to implement a policy that satisfies the definition of genocide, a deliberate policy that's effectively killed well over 1 million individuals, children, and adults. History will slaughter those responsible." We are also joined by David Mack, Vice President of the Middle East Institute and former ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Near Eastern Affairs from 1990 to 1993. Dennis Halliday, your assessment of the Clinton years when it comes to Iraq?
Well, extremely disappointing. I mean, they continued the process of killing Iraqi children through maintaining the sanctions regime in the full knowledge of its genocidal impact. We had the Secretary of State acknowledging the death of 500,000 Iraqi children and justifying it. We had the bombing, the Ramadan bombing of December of 98. They've continued the no-fly zone bombing of north and south Iraq, which has killed civilians, terrified thousands of Iraqi children, as has been reported in Basra by those from Voices in the Wilderness who were there recently. On top of that, we've contained this congressional decision of, what is it, $100 million to overthrow President Saddam Hussein, which completely undermines any possibility of collaboration between Baghdad, the United Nations, and the United States. So it's a very disappointing period, it seems to me. There was no effort to bring an end to this calamity in Iraq, or to bring an end to the death, as you say, of perhaps over 1 million innocent Iraqi civilians. And that is not even touching on the crimes committed against humanity by the Gulf, UN, U.S. allies during the Gulf War.
David Mack, you were a former ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. So your response to Dennis Halliday's assessment?
Well, I've talked to Dennis before, and I know his views. They're not new. They haven't changed one bit. They haven't changed one bit during the period of time in which the United Nations has provided a new and really very forthcoming proposal for a modification of the terms of the Oil for Food program, a modification that would provide the Iraqis an opening for a suspension of UN sanctions. However, the Iraqi government continues to oppose the return to Iraq of any weapons inspectors under UN auspices. And as a result, we do have continuing problems in Iraq. I'm not going to deny that there is suffering in Iraq. The question is, what caused the suffering? The facts are these, that as early as the summer of 1991, the UN Security Council, by a unanimous vote, proposed a program allowing Iraq to sell oil in return for use of the revenues for food and medicine. And it was 5 years before the government of Saddam Hussein accepted this, 5 years in which they deliberately inflicted upon their own people privation in order to gain world sympathy for the lifting of economic sanctions. And now we see an even more generous UN resolution that would greatly broaden the categories, not only for food and medicine. There are no longer any restrictions on food and medicine imports, but would greatly expand the categories for other economically useful commodities, for rebuilding the sanitation systems and the water systems and the educational systems, agricultural systems. And yet the Iraqi government still prefers to stonewall, hoping that eventually they can get out from under sanctions totally without having to accept any renewed weapons inspectors.
Well, I'd like to, if I can interrupt, just to ask Dennis Halliday. I mean, there are those who support sanctions who say, well, Iraq is selling almost as much oil now on the world market as it was before the Persian Gulf War. So how do you respond then to what David Mack is raising?
Well, since the end of 1996, when the Oil for Food program began, Iraq has sold about $35 billion worth of oil, of which the United Nations takes 35% off the top, leaving a net, which is a good deal smaller, obviously. And of that net, less than $10 billion has been delivered to Iraq through the United Nations. So $10 billion worth of food and medicines divided by 4 years, divided by 22 million people. It does not go very far. But the fact is, the United Nations is applying politics to a humanitarian crisis for which the Security Council in the United States in particular is responsible, for maintaining a death grip on the people of Iraq in order to punish, I guess, Baghdad, and failing totally. I mean, Baghdad is stronger than ever. The people are weaker than ever. It's a crisis of massive proportions.
We got a chance to talk to the president about the Iraqi policy, and this is what he had to say on Election Day when it came to what you've called the genocide in Iraq, Dennis Halliday. President Clinton, UN figures show that up to 5,000 children a month die in Iraq because of the sanctions against
Iraq. That's not true. That's not true. And that's not what they show. Let me just tell you something. Before the sanctions, the year before the Gulf War, you said this. How much money did Iraq earn from oil? Answer, $16 billion. How much money did Iraq earn last year from oil? How much money did they get? Cash on the barrel held to Saddam Hussein. Answer, $19 billion that he can use exclusively for food, for medicine, to develop his country. He's got more money now, $3 billion a year more than he had 9 years ago. If any child is without food or medicine or a roof over his or her head in Iraq, it's because he is claiming the sanctions are doing it and sticking it to his own children. We have worked like crazy to make sure that the embargo only applies to his ability to reconstitute his weapon system and his military state. This is a guy who butchered the children of his own country, who were Kurds, who were Shiites. He used chemical weapons on his own people. And he is now lying to the world and claiming the mean old United States is killing his children. He has more money today than he did before the embargo. And if they're hungry or they're not getting medicine, it's his own fault.
The past two UN heads of the program in Iraq have quit, calling the U.S. Policy, U.S. UN policy, genocidal. What is your response to that?
They're wrong. They think that we should reward Hunter. Saddam Hussein says, I'm going to starve my kids unless you let me buy nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons. If you let me do everything I want to do so I can get in a position to kill and intimidate people again, then I'll stop starving my kids. And so we're supposed to assume responsibility for his misconduct. That's just not right.
President Clinton talking about, well, responding to you, one of the heads of the Oil for Food program, Dennis Halliday, saying you're wrong that this is genocidal policy.
It's frightening for me, and I'm sure for many Americans and others around the world, to hear the president of the United States being so ill-informed and not knowing, in fact, the realities. As I said before, the income to the Iraqis is very modest when it's channeled through the United Nations with, as I said, a huge 35% taken off the top. And the fact is that whereas today, hopefully, most Iraqis are having a reasonable intake of food, although it's not a balanced diet, the chief killer of young children, as UNICEF reports, is through waterborne disease. And that's because the United States bombed and destroyed electric power production capability, water treatment and distribution, and sanitation capacity within Iraq. And that is what is killing young children, particularly under 12 years. We've got a situation in Iraq today where young mothers are anemic. They're giving birth to children on average less than 5 pounds, which in itself is an indicator of famine. And we, the West, the United States, are responsible for sustaining this program. To claim that Saddam Hussein is the only villain in town is, of course, nonsense. The fact is there are politics being played in Baghdad and in Washington. And, of course, who loses? But, of course, the innocent and particularly the children of Iraq.
And Dennis continues to dodge the question of who's responsible for this, because the issue really is, do you continue to have the United Nations controlling the revenues from Iraq's sale of oil in order to assure that the great majority of those revenues will be spent for economically useful purposes for Iraq's people? Or do you simply turn $20 billion a year over to Saddam Hussein and let him spend it however he wants to spend it? Now, personally, I'm not worried about him building palaces or importing Scotch whiskey. I'm far more worried about the fact that he is going to make use of those revenues to perpetuate his repression of the Iraqi people and to keep himself and his clique in power indefinitely by using the revenues to reward and punish various segments of the Iraqi population. And at the same time, he'll have the ability to reconstitute weapons of mass destruction that will threaten the whole region. And, you know, this is really the issue. If you talk to Iraqi exiles, and there are millions of Iraqi exiles, they left Iraq for a good reason. I served twice in Baghdad. The second time I was there, in the late 70s, Saddam Hussein was in power. And I can assure you, Iraqis were leaving in droves.
Dennis Halliday,
10 seconds. And this was the middle of the of an oil boom when Iraq should have been benefiting.
We have to end the program, sorry to say.
Well, I think it's tragic to continue the demonization of Saddam Hussein alone. We are all criminal through the Gulf War and other inputs into Iraq. Let's open a dialogue. Let's change the relationship and let's address the problem of the people.
Dennis Halliday, former Assistant Secretary General of the UN and a former Ambassador David Mack. That does it for the program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our executive producer. Juan Gonzalez, I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! From the embattled studios of WBAI in New York.